This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Steve Miller, and here's what's coming up.
We will overcome. We will defeat the attack and stop the bleeding of our economy. We will overcome attempts at destabilization of our society by a few rogue Zimbabweans acting in league with foreign detractors.
That's Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa blaming many of the country's problems on alleged internal and international sabotage. And the Nigerian Medical Association is concerned about doctors and other health workers moving to other countries. The acting UN envoy to Libya is working on a plan to separate Libya's two warring sides. And World Breastfeeding Week underscores concerns about COVID-19. Those stories and more are all next on Africa News Tonight. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa is putting the blame for the country's problems just about everywhere, except on his government. His unexpected national address this morning raised concerns that the crackdown on opponents and critics could get even tougher. Reporter Kudzai Zinavashi has more from Harare.
The speech came just days after a planned national protest that was quashed as the government shut down urban centers, citing a surge in COVID-19 cases, and leading opponents were allegedly abducted. Mnangagwa detailed the series of challenges his government has encountered, citing instigators inside and outside the country and forces of nature.
My administration has faced the many hurdles and attacks since its inauguration. These included the divisive politics of some opposition elements, the illegal economic sanctions, cyclones, droughts, and more recently, the deadly COVID-19 pandemic. Added to this is economic aggression, local currency manipulation, and detractors who fear the inevitable imminent success of our reforms.
Mnangagwa said his government will still persevere.
We will overcome. We will defeat the attack and stop the bleeding of our economy. We will overcome attempts at destabilization of our society by a few rogue Zimbabweans acting in league with foreign detractors.
The president called for peace, love, unity, hard work, transparency, and patriotism against the dark forces that have been sowing divisions between citizens. Political analyst Rashid Mukundu says the president's address is worrying.
The dissonance in Emmerson Mnangagwa's message is quite astounding. In one moment, he talks of terrorists, talking of crushing his opponents. And then the next moment, he's talking of love and unity. So it appears that he is a man who is contradicting himself. As a national leader, you don't come out on national television to threaten citizens.
Mukundu says such threats give credence to worrying reports of gross human rights violations in Zimbabwe. Critics worry that today's speech suggests a further escalation of the ongoing crackdown on human rights and political activists. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashi from Harare.
There are increasing calls from prominent South Africans for the South African Development Community and the African Union to demand an end to human rights abuses in Zimbabwe that have been called part of an effort to silence dissent. Former South African public protector Thuli Madonsela and the country's third largest party, the Economic Freedom Fighters Party leader, are among those who have criticized the current crackdown, arbitrary arrests, beatings, and intimidation of civilians by government security forces. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Thuli Madonsela, who is respected for her passion in fighting for the disadvantaged during her tenure as public protector, says there are no excuses for human rights abuses being committed by the government of Zimbabwe.
I just find it strange and quite frankly unacceptable that by simply voicing disagreement with the way government does things. People have to be arrested and then it will take a court of law to decide whether they're guilty or not. That's not what the rule of law requires. This is intimidation.
Julius Malema, the leader of South Africa's third largest political party, wants the Zimbabwean embassy in South Africa shut until authorities stop the crackdown amid concerns that it is getting worse. And former Democratic Alliance Party leader Musi Maimane has also called on the African continent to speak out against the abuses. He wants those committing criminal acts to be brought to book. Amnesty International has also weighed in. Muleya Mwananyanda is deputy director at the group's Southern Africa office.
Things really do need to change. The abductions need to change. The arrests need to change. The torture needs to stop happening. The sexual assaults on women need to stop happening. None of those things have been accounted for right now. And Zimbabweans are crying out to the region to come in and address some of the issues that Zimbabweans have been raising for years and years.
Zimbabwean activists and political parties are also piling pressure on President Ramaphosa to intervene. Ntolisi Ncube, the spokesperson of Zimbabwe's new political party, the Patriotic Front Party, is urging South Africa to stop its quiet diplomacy and intervene before it's too late.
South Africa is one of the countries bearing the brunt of what is happening, especially the political and economic crisis in Zimbabwe, should be at the forefront of trying to resolve these issues because it's hosting around 3 million Zimbabweans in an estimated level. We appeal to him to rally the whole of the African continent behind the people of Zimbabwe and what they are crying for.
Mabuto Mabena is the Secretary General of the South African-based Zimbabwe Communist Party. He says his party is writing President Ramaphosa a letter detailing the abuses.
Thina njenge Zimbabwe Communist Party sibhala ugwalo esifisa ukudlulisela kumongameli weSouth Africa uCyril Ramaphosa lebandla lakhe African National Congress. Esikunanzelelayo ukuthi mhlawumbe bengabe thola inkulumo eziphikisanayo bengabi lolwazi ukuthi kuyini kahle kahle okwenzakalayo.
Till now, South Africa has not uttered a word on the abuses. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Stephanie Williams, acting UN envoy to Libya, warns that the constant influx of mercenaries and weapons to Libya risks miscalculations around the strategic coastal city of Sirte. She's working on a plan to separate the two warring sides. Wolfgang Putze, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, argued that the European Union has a suitable tool to establish a buffer zone between the Government of National Accord and the Libyan National Army with very short notice using the EU battle groups. He explained the need for a buffer zone to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, I would say Stephanie Williams is certainly right. Any kind of ceasefire without international surveillance or enforcement and a buffer zone will be rather short-lived. The feasibility of Williams' plan depends on if both sides realize that they cannot defeat the other party and that there is at least currently no military way for them to end the current stalemate successfully by military means. The feasibility of the plan depends also on if Turkey and Operation Volcano can accept that they can't take the east of Libya. And on the other side, it depends also on if the LNA realizes that they cannot force Turkey out from western Libya with military means. The current demands from both sides a little bit going into a different direction. From Turkey and the GNA and Operation Volcano demand that the LNA withdraws from Sirte, Al-Jufra and the oil crescent. And on the other side, the LNA demands that Turkey withdraws entirely from Libya altogether with its Syrian mercenaries. This is certainly not realistic, neither the first one nor the second one. On the other side, with regard to the international actors, Egypt could easily accept such a buffer zone because this would secure indirectly also its western borders. However, some in the east and also in Egypt fear that Turkey and Operation Volcano could use such a ceasefire for a massive build-up of forces and a subsequent attack on the east from inside.
You argued that the European Union has a suitable tool available to establish a buffer zone between the GNA and the LNA with a very short notice using the European Union battle groups. Can you explain that?
Yes, sure. These European Union battle groups are brigade-sized, about 4,000 troops, multinational rapid reaction forces on standby for a six-month period on a rotational basis. Since July 1st, a German-led paratrooper and an Italian-Spanish amphibious EU battle group are on standby. The terrain west of Sirte is characterized by open desert with some salt marshes and a few wadis and just two major roads. Surveillance would be therefore easy. It would be an easy military task. The military task for the peace force would also include the establishment and enforcement of a buffer zone and additionally the surveillance of troop movements in the neighborhood of this zone. Let's say between Abu Ghraib and Bin Jawad, 200 kilometers to the west, 200 kilometers to the east, and down to the south to the Jufra oasis, to survey such a demilitarized zone. Of course, for this, the EU would also need an air and a maritime component. The maritime component could evolve from Operation Irini. Certain preconditions are, of course, to be met before such a deployment. First and foremost, the European Union must be willing to assume for the first time a serious role in Libya, within the framework of its own common security and defense policy. A ceasefire must be agreed and the GNA, Operation Volcano on one side, and the HOR and the Libyan National Army on the other side, must give their consent to the deployment of EU forces. So there is no forced entry or something like this. Both sides must agree to withdraw most of their forces from nearby this buffer zone after the arrival of the EU battle group and eventually to the establishment of a no-fly zone around Sirte. Of course, a UN mandate would be required to authorize and legitimate the peace force. The European Union certainly does not want to end up in an endless mission in Libya. Therefore, an exit strategy is necessary. And this exit strategy could foresee the withdrawal of the ground forces from Libya at the latest 2 years after Libya-wide elections took place. Such a mission, and this is certainly of concern in Europe, would not be without political and military risk. The deployment of such an interpositioning force could be a step closer to a de facto division of Libya between Turkey and the LNA, including Russia. But I would say the common exploitation of the oil resources, especially in the Sirte Basin, could be the glue keeping the country together in something like a federalist state. From a military point, the EU force could become subject to direct attacks by one of the many terrorist groups or by some hardliners on one side or the other. So it's certainly a risky mission, but I would say it's worth the risk.
Africa's participation in a trial that aims to find a vaccine for COVID-19 is now well on track, with hundreds of people enrolled in the study. It's happening in South Africa in collaboration with Oxford University in the United Kingdom. In Johannesburg, reporter Darren Taylor spoke with one of the first people to be given the substance that scientists hope will end one of the greatest health crises in modern history.
My wife was a little upset with me, more because of the concern for me than out of anything else.
Professor Martin Vella is Dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences at Wits University.
Lots of people are fearful of going into studies. One needs to always be well informed, and I was in the fortunate position of being well informed. So, no, I wasn't particularly concerned, and my relatives, well, you know, that was my decision eventually.
Vella explains that the first leg of his journey as a trial participant began at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital in Soweto.
It was remarkably well organized. It was really absolutely incredibly professionally done. I had been there a few days before to get screened. They wanted to firstly make sure that people who were going on to study were not carrying the virus and also had not shown signs of a previous infection.
After the necessary blood tests, it was time to step up to the plate, as the academic puts it.
And then, yeah, I was given an injection. What is in the injection, I don't know, and will only know once the study is unblinded.
Vella says he wasn't nervous because none of the 5,000 people who've already received the substance in the UK have reported any major adverse effects.
It is not an attenuated form of the virus, so it is in fact another virus that only carries a particular gene for one of the components of the coronavirus. And the virus that is used is an adenovirus that in itself has already been manipulated so that it causes very mild symptoms, if it causes any symptoms at all.
He believes a vaccine is the only way to stop the devastation that COVID-19 is wreaking. And it'll be great if he can help turn it into just another nuisance virus by participating in the trial.
Having the background information, not being particularly concerned about the safety because it has been shown to be safe, and because we really are desperately needing it, I felt it was my civic duty to do so.
Vela says it's very important for Africa and the world that the continents involved in the study.
Every health intervention needs to be tested across as broad a spectrum of people as possible in order to be absolutely sure that it is effective and equally effective across the world. There's lots and lots of examples of medications and other interventions that just do different things in different parts of the world.
He's convinced that South Africa's participation will help the continent to access the vaccine when it's eventually available.
To a large degree, I think that there's a moral obligation on the part of the manufacturers and the suppliers of these agents to ensure that if these have been studied in particular populations, that they also make them available to those populations.
Feller says drug multinationals often ignore Africa because they can't make enormous profits on the continent. He hopes that South Africa's presence in the vaccine trial will override this situation and ultimately save millions of African lives. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
During normal times, World Breastfeeding Week brings hundreds of workshops, speeches, and celebrations touting the health benefits for young children and, indirectly, for their mothers. COVID-19 has forced this week's commemoration online, but the value of breastfeeding for infant nutrition and the family budget are still crucial. Early in the pandemic, there was concern among many mothers that COVID-19 could be transmitted through breast milk and a tendency to avoid visits to clinics for fear of contracting the virus. Now, to find out more about these concerns, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Toyin Adelawale-Gabriel, the advocacy and policy advisor for the FHI Solutions Alive and Thrive Initiative in Nigeria.
Well, as you know, the COVID-19 pandemic situation is unprecedented. At first, there was initially some confusion for mothers in relation to breastfeeding and COVID. Also, there was a significant drop in attendance at clinics and also for immunization because mothers felt that coming to the facility put them at risk of infection. But then a lot of work has been done with new guidance says that once you follow the protocols, wearing of the face mask and also making sure that the hands are washed, it's safe to continue to breastfeed. So gradually, as the restrictions have been eased in Nigeria, there's also been a corresponding increase at the facilities.
So there is no transmission of COVID through breast milk itself?
No, there is no evidence that there's COVID transmission through the breast milk. But breast milk is a baby's first immunization. So it's very important to also ensure that mothers continue to breastfeed their babies.
Tell us again why breast milk is so important.
Breast milk is medicine. It has all the nutrients that the baby needs to keep growing for the first 1,000 days of life. And it's very, very important that mothers and families maximize the benefits of breast milk, especially in this COVID-19 pandemic, to provide the most immunity against disease they can provide for their babies.
Of course, the economic impact of COVID has meant widespread economic dislocation, along with fear of famine.
Well, you know, the National Bureau of Statistics have done some studies on the economic impact of the pandemic on livelihoods. And you can see the inflation since May has been growing month by month. Things are extremely expensive, but breast milk comes cost-free. It's available. And the science is out there that even when the mother does not have enough nutrition for herself, she's still able to provide enough breast milk for her baby. And so the family is free of the cost associated with infant formula, which is very expensive, you know, and it's not advised.
I know that organizers for this year's World Breastfeeding Week have linked environmental awareness with their normal recommendations in favor of breast milk.
Yes, the thematic tone for this year's World Breastfeeding Week is about breast milk in support of the environment. And we do know, you know, the breast milk substitutes from the production to the packaging process to landfills and environmental pollution.
Speaking of infant formula, I'm told there was a significant ramp up in corporate marketing of formula during the days when people were not so sure that babies would not get COVID through breast milk.
That's correct. And there's been a lot of international effort to push back against the aggressive marketing. If you are going to do a donation, it should not be branded. But in this context, because of the panic, a lot of marketing was going on.
Through radio and TV and other media?
Not on the media, but through so-called humanitarian efforts, donations of branded breast milk. You know, so it was time to make a public statement on the need to comply with the code.
That was Toyin Adewale-Gabriel, the advocacy and policy advisor for FHI Solutions' Alive and Thrive initiative. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The Nigerian Medical Association says it's concerned about the migration of doctors and other health workers to other countries, creating a shortage at home. The association says the doctors need a conducive environment and good welfare package to remain in Nigeria. Mike Mbonye reports from Lagos.
Professor Innocent Uja is president of the Nigerian Medical Association, the professional body that registers doctors and dentists in the country. Uja says about 45,000 doctors belong to the association, though he admitted some have left for greener pastures abroad. The United Kingdom's General Medical Council says no fewer than 7,875 Nigerian doctors are currently practicing there. Uja says there is need to improve the welfare of Nigerian doctors to foster enough satisfaction so they don't feel they have to leave. He says the doctors who have stayed in Nigeria are doing their best to fight COVID-19 despite losing some colleagues.
Doctors are doing their best within the environment they find themselves. Things are not adequate. You will realize that we're talking about the provision of PPEs and create a W environment, and also provision for hazard allowance and also life insurance for the frontline workers, because this is a very risky virus and we need to protect the workers.
Uja says Nigeria is well prepared to train doctors and other health workers.
Nigeria has the potentials, as you may have realized, apart from the medical schools in many, many universities in Nigeria, at least about 30, 32 medical schools are currently in Nigeria. Apart from that, there is a new dimension where specialized universities of health sciences are being established.
Dr. Clifford Okafor, a private medical practitioner, isn't worried about the losses. He says the doctors are free to migrate and seek better working conditions.
If anybody doesn't have what is enough for him here, or doesn't have an employment, or is not satisfied by the way he's been taken care of, if he has opportunity overseas, they should go. There are many doctors to take care of us here. There are very many Nigerian doctors. Many have always been overseas. So I do not see it as a very serious matter. And then I believe that they can never drain the entire Nigerian workforce of doctors.
But Okafor says the government should ensure that doctors and other health workers attending to COVID-19 patients get the protective equipment they need. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
Tundu Lissu, the vice chairman of Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, who just returned to the country a week ago after undergoing treatment in Belgium for an assassination attempt 3 years ago, has been nominated to run for president in October. His candidacy has to be approved by a meeting of party delegates today, and if endorsed, he would challenge President John Magufuli in the election. In a speech yesterday to the party's general council, he warned they should be prepared to resist ruling party efforts to throw roadblocks in their way. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.